Menoikius's son, my wife's own brother, Creon, went at my command to Pytho, Phoebus's abode, to learn if something I can say or do will save the state. I'm worried, measuring the time. I wonder what he's doing there. His absence seems unduly long. But when he finally comes, then I'm no good at all if I don't do whatever God commands.
And there's the rub, because Oedipus himself is the problem. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Sophocles and other writers of ancient Greek tragedies were fascinated by the role of fate in the lives of men and women. What did they have to say about free will, though? Who was Sophocles writing for? And, of course, that classic question, did Oedipus have an Oedipus complex? Our guest is David Mulroy, professor of classics at the UW-Milwaukee, translator of the complete poetry of Catullus. His translation of Oedipus Rex is a 2011 publication of the University of Wisconsin Press.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thanks, Emily. I'm happy to be here.
You know, rereading Oedipus, Sophocles' play, I was struck just by the incredible irony of this man who's cursing the murderer of his, you know, it's just he's cursing himself without knowing it. Can you give us sort of the boiled down plot of Oedipus?
Well, yes, it's a little complicated, but basically it starts with Jocasta and Laios, the queen and king of Thebes. They're worried about whether they'll have children, so they send to the oracle for advice, and the oracle says, yes, indeed, you'll have a son, and that son will kill his father. So with that information, when Jocasta gives birth to a baby boy, they decide the baby has to be destroyed. They drive a spike through his ankles and give him to a servant, referred to as Laios' man, to dispose of. Laios' man feels sorry for the baby and takes it away to another childless couple, Polybus and Merope, the king and queen of Corinth. So Oedipus is raised as the child of Polybus and Merope. When he gets to be about 20, he hears rumors that he's illegitimate. So he goes to the Oracle of Delphi to ask about that. The Oracle doesn't clarify the question of his birth parents, but says, in effect, oh, no, you have the worst fate of anyone I've ever seen. You're destined to kill your father and marry your mother. And Oedipus thinks, well, that's a horrible fate. I'll do anything to avoid that. I'll never go home to my parents, Polybus and Merope. I'll go anywhere else. So he runs off in the opposite direction, as fate would have it, toward the city of Thebes. And there, coming down the road, he sees an elderly man with an entourage. They fight over the right of way, and he ends up killing the old fellow and his companions.
And this is all backstory so far, by the way. This is not even in the play, but this is all stuff that comes out, isn't it?
That's right. It's all told as a flashback.
And the elderly man that gets killed is the king.
Is none other than Laios himself. So Oedipus has fulfilled the first part of the oracle without knowing it. He also killed the old man's companions, but he thought he'd killed them all, but there was one survivor who turns out to be Laios's man, the same servant who has been given the job of exposing.
And it's really just a matter of road rage, isn't it? This is what prompts the killing.
Yes.
As they pass by in their conveyance and sort of brush him off the road, and he takes it badly, and that's how it all sets in action.
One of the questions which has been debated endlessly is whether Oedipus is in any way at fault for killing his father and marrying his mother. And this incident at the crossroads is crucial. He describes it in some detail in flashback, but even with his description, it's hard to say whether his anger was justified or not.
And how does he end up marrying his mother after killing Laios?
About the same time that he killed Laios, a monster, the Sphinx, materializes in the countryside, asking a riddle and killing anybody that can't answer it. So back in Thebes, Jocasta's brother Creon is left with this double problem. The king has just been killed, and there's a monster. So evidently, he issues a decree saying that anybody who can answer the monster's riddle can become the new king because we have this vacancy, and in addition can marry the widowed queen Jocasta. So Oedipus arrives in town at that juncture and answers the riddle of the Sphinx and becomes the king and marries Jocasta and settles down with her. And they have four children.
So we should say at this point that he really doesn't have an Oedipus complex, does he? Because he doesn't want to kill his father and he doesn't want to marry his mother. It just works out that way.
Well, there is some ambiguity there. The critical moment in my mind comes when Oedipus consults the oracle. And remember, he went there to ask who his parents are.
Right.
And the oracle didn't answer that question but says, you're going to kill your father and marry your mother. And then he runs off, avoiding Corinth, as if he were absolutely sure that his real parents were Polybus and Merope. Now, if he had paused for a moment and thought through the situation, he would have realized that he didn't know who his parents were, and that when he then encountered an old man and they started to fight, it would surely have occurred to him, this old man could be my father. So I think if Sigmund Freud had met Oedipus weaving the oracle and asked him a few questions, he could have elicited from Oedipus an admission that subconsciously he really was okay with killing his father.
When you get into that subconscious, yes, that's a, it's
yes,
a deep
right,
delving.
Right, right, yeah.
And is there any sort of historical background for this legend of Oedipus? I mean, when Sophocles is writing about it or other Greek playwrights that picked up the same topic, are they drawing on bits of history?
It's very unlikely. There is one theory connecting Oedipus with an Egyptian pharaoh, Akhenaten, I think, who is depicted as having swollen feet in Egyptian artwork. So there's at least a theory that the story has some roots, not in Greece, but in Egypt. But that's a bit of a stretch, I think.
Does Oedipus have a meaning? Of course, you're saying Oedipus, yeah, and that whole ambiguity of how even to pronounce the name or a lot of ancient Greek, but does it have a meaning?
The name Oedipus? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, it does. It can be interpreted as meaning swollen foot. The pus part means foot. And the oid at the beginning, or what we say ed, can be the root meaning swollen. So he has swollen feet from the spike that was driven through his ankles.
So.
And it also could be interpreted as meaning knowing feet, because the secret the secret to his identity lay in his feet, which he should have known about.
And what time frame are we talking about? Is Sophocles even pinning this to earlier times? When is he writing it?
Yeah,
and when
all
is
of
the
these Greek myths are set in the Greek Bronze Age, around 1300 B.C. That's the real historical context for these heroes of Greek myth, Oedipus, Heracles, Perseus, and all of them. So that is a good 700 or 800 years before Sophocles lived. He has that setting in mind. It's the distant legendary past that he's ostensibly talking about. But a lot that goes on in these Greek tragedies is reflective of issues and situations in contemporary Greek city-states. There's a real duality there.
And what's important to know about Sophocles himself? I mean, I know he wrote other things like Antigone and Electra, a lot of other plays, but what makes him sort of distinctive as a playwright, and what do you think attracted him to the myth of Oedipus?
He was an amazing artist. He had a career that spanned 60 years, and he was 70 when he wrote Oedipus Rex, and he continued writing until he was 90. His plays were written for the Festival of Dionysus in Athens, which was an annual contest in which tragic poets submitted tetralogies, sets of four plays, and in each contest there were three poets competing, and the winner was selected like an annual Academy Award. Sophocles won first prize 20 times in his career, and second prize 8 times, and never third place. He was an amazing talent. His earlier play seems relatively lighthearted. A very early one was about a great poet who challenged the 9 muses to a music contest. The deal was that if he won, he would get to sleep with all the 9 muses. And if he lost, the muses could exact any penalty they chose. Unfortunately, he lost, and the muses deprived him of eyesight and musical ability as his penalty. So,
Well, it's worth a try, I guess.
It's worth a try. Yeah, that's
well,
a
what
one.
Do we yeah. miss, those of us but, who don't read Greek, what do we miss by not reading it in the original the way, obviously, you've worked on this new translation and you've read Sophocles' Oedipus in its original Greek form?
Sure, yeah. That's a wonderful question. To me, the Greek tragedies, when you read them in the original Greek, are extremely dynamic. The spoken parts are positively telegraphic. There are no wasted words. And the spoken parts are written in a strict iambic meter, so there's a constant forward momentum, so that the plays are riveting, exciting to listen to. Some translations, I think, make them sound somewhat florid and bombastic, and that's the wrong idea altogether.
And then the choruses, would they be more inclined to speak in rhyme?
Well, the Greeks themselves didn't use rhyme, but the choral songs were sung to musical accompaniment, and they were written in strict meter to fit the melody to which they were sung. Now, we don't know what those melodies are, so we have no way of recapturing the songs of Greek tragedy. Often these days, they're translated into free verse. And free verse, I think, carries with it a kind of a characteristic obscurity. Free verse is challenging to understand. And that gives you exactly the wrong impression of the songs of Greek tragedy. They were the most popular parts of the Greek tragedy. People would go home humming the songs. They were easy to memorize because they fit into this meter. So I made the decision in doing my translation, which is undoubtedly controversial. Not everybody would endorse it. But I decided to translate the choral songs into short rhyme stanzas, not because the Greeks used rhyme. They didn't. But because to us, rhyme stanzas sound musical, mm-hmm. and they're easy to remember. And it seems to me they have the same quality of aesthetic pleasure that the choral songs had in tragedy.
So this is really a format that's still with us today. I mean, this combination of dialogue and musical numbers is the same as you would find in a musical on Broadway.
Absolutely. That's exactly right.
Can you give us a sample in Greek and then maybe talk about sort of the challenges it would present when you translated it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. For the Greek, reading the choral songs in Greek doesn't make much sense. We don't know the rhythm. But we do know the spoken parts, and they're written in lines of six iambs apiece. Here's how the play begins. O technikad mu tu palai nea trophei, Tinas pothedras tasta moetho adzate, hikteri ois kladoisen exostem menoi, polisto mu menthu miamaton game. Each line consists of six iambic feet. Each line contains what's known as a caesura, although the metrical beat is iambic, meaning unstressed, stressed. There's at least one word ending in a troche in every line, and this to me seems central in creating the rhythm.
So in other words, there's a pause in
there's
the break in each line.
A momentary pause, a momentary break mm-hmm. that somehow makes the rhythm effective.
And what did you just say?
literally it says, O children of Cadmus, the ancient one, the new production of the children of Cadmus, what sittings are these that you hasten for me? I'm translating it very literally, wreathed with suppliant branches, and the city at the same time is full of incense. This is Oedipus addressing a crowd that has gathered around his palace in order to ask for help in ending the plague. Here's my translation of those lines and what follows. Oedipus says, Children of Cadmus, ancient king's new brood, why have you taken seats before me here as suppliants with olive boughs and wreaths? Meanwhile, the city's full of fragrant smoke and loud with sacred songs and cries of grief. Not thinking it correct to hear about such matters secondhand, I came myself, the celebrated man called Oedipus. But tell me, ancient sir, it's only right for you to be their spokesman. What accounts for this? Some fear or longing? I'll assist in every way. He'd be a callous man who didn't pity suppliants like these. That illustrates my approach to translating the spoken parts of the play. They're in a strict iambic pentameter. Each of the lines has 10 syllables. And somewhere along the line in working on this, I discovered that the lines that really seemed rhythmic to me were the ones that had the caesura, and I went back and redid the translation to incorporate caesuras in every line. So that, like the last line, who didn't pity suppliants like these, pity is the trochaic word, who didn't pity suppliants like these, and it creates the caesura.
Are there concepts that are just really hard to translate or hard to translate in the stricture of that iambic pentameter?
It's the proper names that give you the most trouble.
To fit them into the scheme.
Fit them in,
really.
Yeah.
They're hard enough to say, too.
Yeah. They're hard enough to say. That's right. You have to settle on some pronunciation of them and fit them into the line. But it's mostly the proper names, the names of gods and goddesses and cities and so forth that create the greatest problem. With various concepts, you have a good bit of flexibility. You can approach them from different directions.
How does the beginning of this play compare with the beginnings of other plays by Sophocles? It's not quite in medias res, but there is trouble in town.
Yeah. Well, I've been working on the Antigone, and that starts in a much more private moment. I guess this is a little unusual in that it focuses right away on Oedipus and his public persona, addressing a crowd. The other plays usually start essentially in a domestic scene. I not thought of that before, but then, since you asked, that's the difference that comes to mind. In a sense, it's a very political, a very public play.
And what makes it stand out among the others of Sophocles? Those other, how many plays did he write?
Well, he wrote, we figure, 128 about, but only seven survived.
We just have the seven?
We just have the seven.
That's and right. Those are all considered masterpieces.
They are. They were selected by scholars of the Hellenistic period, in a century or so after Sophocles lived. They were considered his seven best, and there were seven selected by Aeschylus, too.
As you were working on the lines to have Oedipus speak, yeah, starting with that opening speech, what kind of sense did you have of his character, his, you know, so-called tragic flaws? You know, so often in Greek tragedy, there's a character who's full of pride or rage or blindness of some kind. I mean, as you're working with his lines, what sort of character emerges for you?
To me, he comes across as very headstrong and... Well, here I disagree with some other scholars and interpreters of the play, but to me his chief characteristic is his ability to blind himself to facts that he does not want to acknowledge. It seems to me that runs throughout the play.
And the figurative becomes literal.
At the end, the figurative becomes literal, and he blinds himself. I've always thought that's the strongest evidence in support of this interpretation, that Oedipus is every man, and we're all vulnerable to ignoring facts that we don't want to acknowledge, facts that create restraints in our behavior. It's so easy just to not know what we don't want to know, but that makes us vulnerable to doing horrible things, and of course, in Oedipus's case, the most horrible imaginable things.
What about the fact that he runs away? I mean, he goes to the oracle and hears this sort of bad fate,
yeah,
and just sort of runs away rather than staying in contact with his parents, or...
Uh-huh.
You know, is there any suggestion that wasn't okay to just sort of leave?
Well, Oedipus's defenders make a major point of the fact that nobody criticizes his behavior in the course of the play. And it's arguably a rational thing to do. You're told that you have this terrible fate waiting for you in Corinth, and so you decide, I'll never go back to Corinth.
But he doesn't tell the parents that raised him.
He doesn't know. That's true. He doesn't.
He could say, hey, Mom, well, Dad.
That's right. It's hard to tell how much of this stuff is just so intrinsic to the plot that it can't be gotten rid of. But it's amazing how little Oedipus seems to have communicated with other people that are significant in his life. Yeah, he could have sent them a message.
Yeah.
They do have messengers in this play,
after all.
He could have dispatched one.
The Corinthian comes up.
And, is there ever any evidence in a Greek play that the oracle gets it wrong? Or do you always know when you're listening to play that whatever comes out of the mouth of an oracle
you might
is
not
going to come true.
Be able to figure out what it means.
They're never wrong. In myth and legend, oracles are never wrong, but there is an out. They can be fulfilled figuratively. Oedipus, when he hears that Polybus has died, and he thinks he's off the hook, he says he's dead, and here I am without a weapon, innocent, unless he died for missing me, in which case I killed him. So that shows you that even within the play, oracles could theoretically be fulfilled in a figurative sense.
And it provides a nice sense of drama, too, because here he is kind of hoping against hope that, it could be just this.
Yeah, right.
But we, all of us and the chorus and everybody else except for him knows that, no, it's going to be the worst.
It's going to be the worst. That's right, yeah.
We're going to learn more about Sophocles' religious beliefs and the continuing struggles of Oedipus when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Till these predictions prove their worth, I'll leave the holy shrines alone. Olympia, Abai, and Earth's untouchable omphalic stone. Great Zeus, almighty in repute, deathless sovereign, you should know, men disregard the faded truth revealed to Laios long ago. Apollo's everywhere denied bright honors. Piety has died.
Lines expressing some religious quavering in the immortal play Oedipus Rex by Sophocles. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest David Mulroy, who has a new translation of Oedipus Rex out. And we're looking now at the religious aspects of Sophocles' play. He's writing about events that theoretically would take place around 1300 BC. This is maybe 700 years before his time. But you mentioned earlier, David, that he's also including issues of his own time in this play. Mm-hmm. Is religion one of them?
Religion is obviously one of them. He was a contemporary of the sophists, intellectuals like Protagoras, who challenged religious beliefs in a very radical way. Protagoras is the person who said that man is the measure of all things. And he also said about the gods, I don't know whether they exist or what they're like, and many things prevent me from learning this, including the obscurity of the subject and the brevity of life. So Sophocles lived at a time when there was a great deal of skepticism about inherited religious beliefs. On the other hand, Greek society was pervaded with religious observances and rituals. The Greek tragedy itself was part of the festival of Dionysus. So the whole magnificent edifice of Greek culture was built on a foundation of religion. And in the Greek religion, belief in oracles was an essential feature of Greek religion. So unlike for us, if you didn't believe in at least some of these oracles, that was tantamount to rejecting the gods altogether.
So when Oedipus runs away from his fate, in other words, when he decides, well, I'll leave so that I don't kill my father and marry my mother, is he running away from God, in a sense, running away from the divine plan for him?
In a subtle sense, I think so. The lessons of most of these oracle stories is that people react in the wrong way. They try some expedient to avoid a bad fate. What they should do is simply practice basic virtues. You should be kind and loving and honest and so forth. And it's very unlikely that you would end up killing your father and marrying your mother. But almost always in these morality tales, the person who gets an oracle tries some morally neutral or even wicked way to escape fate rather than simply abiding by traditional virtues.
So pride would be the downfall there in that kind of behavior, to somehow try to override
I guess the
oracle?
The thought that you can outmaneuver the oracles, that
although in Oedipus's defense, I mean, he was trying to save his parents' life. And in a sense, you could argue that his motivation was one of goodness.
Yes, and many people feel that way.
And that the gods are quite cruel and play twisted jokes on people.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he says during the course of the play, it's hard to deny that this what's happened to me is the product of some savage deity, some cruel god's design.
So what is the nature of oracles in the way Sophocles thinks about them? What is an oracle?
Well, there were a number of temples, especially temples of Apollo, where besides offering sacrifice and making prayers, a priest or a priestess would receive questions from devotees and give a divinely inspired answer to the question. The most famous of those oracles is the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi. But there were dozens, if not hundreds, of temples that had similar rituals. In addition to that, there were collections, written collections of ancient oracles, sort of like Nostradamus, I guess, that people would consult from time to time. And when something dramatic would happen, people would come up with an ancient oracle predicting it.
Oh, yes. So, did they tend to be cryptic, those predictions answers?
They did tend to be cryptic, yeah.
And what about the figure of the prophet? Is it Tiresias?
Tiresias,
the blind seer.
The blind seer, right. Well, he plays a critical role in the play. He's the first person that Oedipus consults with. And at first, Tiresias, when he realizes what the question is, he says that he knew these truths well, but he destroyed them. In other words, he was around at the time when Oedipus first killed Laios and answered the riddle of the Sphinx and so forth. And Tiresias, being an inspired prophet, inspired by the god Apollo, knew what was happening. But at this moment in the play, he confesses that he deliberately unknew his knowledge. He shoved it out of his mind. But now it comes rushing back to him. And he tells Oedipus he doesn't want to tell him what he knows. But Oedipus gets angry at him, calls him a traitor, and soon enough, Tiresias loses his temper and blurts out the entire truth. You're the killer of Laios. You live in horrible sin, et cetera, et cetera. And Oedipus is just deaf to this. He thinks that Tiresias and Creon are plotting against him.
Can you give us a sample from your translation of Tiresias sort of spilling the beans?
Oh, yeah. That he becomes quite... it's a couple of magnificent speeches in which he tells Oedipus the truth. Here we go. Tiresias to Oedipus. The man you seek with proclamations far and wide about the death of Laios stands right here. Once called a foreign resident, he'll be revealed a native son of Thebes, but not enjoy the moment. Blind, though born with sight, a beggar, wealthy once, he'll use a staff to steer his steps across a foreign land. His children's father, children's brother, too, his mother's son and husband all in one. He kindly helped his father sow his field and killed him. Go inside, examine that account, and if it's wrong in any way, then call my mantic inspiration false.
He's actually challenging him. He's got his back to the wall that much, Tiresias does, that he's actually challenging the king.
Uh-huh.
Prove me wrong.
Prove me wrong, yeah. Put that in your pipe, as it were. But Oedipus, it doesn't even seem to cross Oedipus's mind that Tiresias could be telling the truth. This is obviously a plot against him. He's being set up.
This seems to have a wonderful psychological validity to it. Do you suppose that's one reason that these plays, and Oedipus in particular, of Sophocles have held up so long, the kind of the depth of character and the psychological validity?
In one word, yes. His characters are, for the most part, very convincing like that. Antigone, the girl who martyrs herself in order to obtain a burial for her brother, has the same kind of psychological depth. It's the depth, it's the plausibility, and it's the inner tensions in these characters. His characters aren't just one way. They admit of a couple of different analyses.
Is this a departure for Greek drama when we get to Sophocles? Is he really in a qualitative way different from the playwrights that came before him?
Well, we only have Aeschylus and Euripides to compare him to. I would say, yes, that Sophocles is the most profoundly true to life. and the person who's the least interested in mere spectacle and dramatic turns of events, and more interested in the human soul.
How about dialogue in Sophocles? Is that different from what we would find previously?
Well, it's very, very good. My impression is that, however, that it's very, very good in the other playwrights, too, that Sophocles doesn't really stand out that way. But he has, especially in this play, he has some wonderful dialogue. The parts of the play that are my favorite to translate and to read are called stichomatha. And these are passages in which characters are conversing with each other, and their conversation is broken down into alternating lines of the same meter.
And the term you used, stichomatha.
Stichomatha, yeah.
What does that mean literally?
Line speech, speaking line by line.
So it's back and forth very quickly.
Yeah, back and forth, line by line. So what it boils down to is you say something in exactly 12 syllables, and I reply in exactly 12 syllables, and you reply back.
Like a ping pong game, then, only with words.
Right, yeah.
Is there a sample that maybe you and Norman could read to give us a sense of that?
I think that would be a lot of fun. There's a the one where the stranger from Corinth comes to town, and he tells Oedipus that Polybus has died. And Oedipus is strangely happy to hear this, and he explains that there was a prophecy that he was going to kill Polybus. And then the Corinthian says, well, there's good news. The Corinthians want you to come back and be their king. And Oedipus says, oh, no, I couldn't do that because of this other prophecy that I'm going to marry Merope, so I can never go back to Corinth because of the prophecy about my parents there. And, you know, I must still fear my mother's. And the Corinthian says, now, is this why you stayed away from town all of these years? And Oedipus says, yes. And the Corinthian says, well, you shouldn't have, because I happen to know something. And it's that portion of the conversation that I think is world-class stichomatha. So why don't you be the Corinthian and I'll be the Oedipus?
It's almost like an analyst, you know. It's almost like Oedipus is talking to his analyst here.
Yeah, I think so.
You fled your family fearing what you said?
Afraid Apollo might fulfill his words.
And sins against your parents stain your soul.
Yes, that's the thing that always frightened me.
Then nothing ever justified your fear.
How could that be if I'm my parents' son?
You weren't related, Polybus and you.
He didn't sire me? Is that your drift?
No more than I. Our credit's equal there.
My father equals some non-entity?
I mean, I'm not your father, nor was he.
Why is it then he always called me son?
You were a gift these very hands conferred.
And yet he loved me deeply, even so?
His prior childlessness had taught him how.
Was I a gift you bought or something found?
Found in the wooded glades of Cithaeron.
What business brought you there, to that locale?
My job was watching over flocks of sheep.
A vagrant shepherd, then, a hired hand.
You're a savior, too, on that occasion, son.
In what distress did you discover me?
You ought to let your ankles testify.
Why, talk about that ancient injury.
You lay with ankles pierced. I set you free.
I suffered infamy in swaddling clothes.
Your very name recalls the circumstance.
Oh, gods, my father's deed or mother's, which?
The man who gave you up could answer that.
I was a gift and not a foundling, then?
You were another shepherd's gift to me.
Which shepherd? Can't you make your meaning clear?
He called himself Laius, man, I think.
That is really kind of an exciting point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, and it by having just one line each, it really gets the energy going.
Well, when you consider that much of the play is these fairly long blocks of I won't say them soliloquies because they are addressed to other people, but fairly long pieces, and then you get into this rapid fire.
The rapid fire
really changes the momentum.
A wonderful contrast, yeah. And I think that's something I try to convey in my translation, is that the plays are really pretty fast moving. Even the longer speeches are.
Well, actually, I mean, rereading this play, rereading Oedipus Rex, I was impressed how quickly it moves. There's certainly no wasted lines in there. I mean, the plot is it's a real meat grinder. You know, once things start, there's no getting out of it.
This is true.
And the irony, I guess, of the fact that we as readers know the truth, and then we watch Oedipus through a long denial. You know, just a long series of denials before he confronts the truth.
Yeah. Although, in the interest of full disclosure, there is some padding at the end of the play. People have pointed out that after Oedipus blinds himself, he appears and he laments with his bleeding eyes. And then he asks Creon to send him into exile. And they go. He goes.
You think
back
it's an anticlimax?
Yeah, right.
Or is it just setting up the sequel?
Then his. It may be setting up the sequel. It's believed that it was padded by some later artist in order to make it more consistent with the sequel that Sophocles eventually wrote, Oedipus at Colonus. And in the padded ending, Oedipus's two young daughters appear on stage. And it's really quite gruesome and unnecessary. He says, "Come to your father's hands, these hands that made my shining eyes see the way they do," pointing to this.
The streams of blood.
And these are not only his daughters, but his sisters, as it turns out.
That adds an extra twist there, too. He goes on saying, who's going to marry you with all of these?
The violence, the Greeks are credited, I think, with showing or not showing violence, reporting violence. The violence happens off stage where it leaves more to your imagination, which is, of course, more terrible than likely the art of the stagecraft could produce. That's true in this play, too, isn't it?
That's very true. Some people get the wrong impression that the Greeks didn't like violence in drama. But what you said is just absolutely spot on. They were very fond of violence, and the best way to represent it was through these wonderful messenger speeches where something horrible happens off stage and a breathless messenger rushes on and describes it in glorious detail.
Can you give us an example of a chorus speech in verse and how that sounds in your translation? And when it says chorus as you're reading a Greek play, would that have been, you know, a person or a group, you know, reciting in unison? What was the chorus?
It was a group of 15, and they're usually adolescent males, although they represented all demographic strata, you know. In this case, they represent the elders of Thebes.
So it would have been 15 people reciting in unison?
Singing in unison. Sometimes chanting, but for the most part, it was a you know, full-fledged musical number, singing and dancing.
And the part of the chorus here seems to be, to a great extent, to, well, reveal kind of what the status of the plot is at this point, and also sometimes, though, to reveal what a character is thinking and sometimes to sympathize with that character.
Right. It's a little hard to generalize. They have their dramatic identities. In this case, they're elders in Thebes, and virtually everything they say is consistent with that dramatic identity. They're not spokesmen for the poet, I don't think, except to the extent that the poet is likely to share the opinions of you know, a representative group of citizens.
Sometimes they almost seem to be rubbing something in. You know?
Yeah. After Oedipus discovers the truth, he says, "Ah, now everything's becoming clear. O light, the last I'll ever see, I stand exposed, all wrong in parents, those with whom I lived, and him I murdered, wrong, all wrong." And he rushes off stage. And then the chorus sings a song. "Spawn of mortal generations here, your lives are nothing. Who of you can say his happiness did more than just appear, and having done so, turned and walked away? If Oedipus's fate's the test, no human state is truly blessed. You shot a lofty arrow unafraid to gain all that for which a mortal strives. You slew the mantic predatory maid, became our fortress, saved our very lives. Our highest honors as the lord and king of Thebes were your reward. But now who has a sadder tale to tell of cruel destruction, toil, reverse of lot? Poor Oedipus, one harbor served you well as child and husband, getting and begot. How could the field your father plowed, when plowed by you, not cry aloud?" So I guess that's a typical reaction of the chorus. They do generalize. Yeah. I like the line, if Oedipus's fate's the test, no human state is truly blessed.
That's certainly succinct.
Yes. And we're going to look at Oedipus and his mother when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. An oracle once came to Laios from, let's say, Apollo's servants, not the god, declaring that whatever child was born to him and me would cause Laios's death. But he was killed by strangers, so we're told, some robbers where a wagon trail divides. The days my baby lived were scarcely three when Laios yoked his feet and had a man abandon him on pathless hills to die. Apollo didn't make his words come true. He didn't make my son a patricide, and Laios didn't die the way he feared. But that was what prophetic tongues foretold.
I suddenly felt dizzy listening just now. My thoughts are racing everywhere.
What's your concern? What startled you like that?
I think I heard you mention Laios being cut down by some divided wagon trail.
That's a conversation between Jocasta and her son and husband, Oedipus, in yes. Sophocles' play Oedipus Rex. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is David Mulroy, who is just completing a translation of Sophocles' Oedipus Rex. One of the most famous sort of, I guess, spin-offs from this play is the phrase Oedipus Complex, mm-hmm. this idea that a boy, for example, might desire secretly his mother, want to get the father out of the way so he can be with the mother. And that's what literally happens in this play. Oedipus unknowingly kills his father and then has married his mother and had children with her. What do you make of this relationship and the sort of Freudian interpretations that swirl around it?
I think that there's something to the Freudian interpretation. These days, most people dismiss it. And I guess it's worth mentioning that Freud himself didn't offer this as an interpretation of Oedipus's actions. He thought of Oedipus's play as being a story about fate and the idea that you can't escape your fate. But he said the reason this particular story fascinates us is because Oedipus's fate just happens to correspond to our repressed desires. So he wasn't exactly interpreting the play.
He was a fairly shrewd interpreter of the arts, statues and plays alike, wasn't he,
Freud? I think so. But what I was going to say is, as I've worked with this play, I've come to believe that Freud's notion that there's some level in which Oedipus wanted to kill his father and marry his mother is actually defensible because of the great mistake he makes when he hears the oracle that he's destined to kill his father. He ought to know that Polybus and Merope aren't his real parents, or probably aren't his real parents. So when he rushes off to wherever and picks a fight with the first elderly man he sees, I think you can make a case that he is subconsciously seeking to embrace his fate.
Oh, I bet there's been a dissertation or two on that, David.
There has. There's a young scholar, a young Russian scholar, who wrote a book on Oedipus, and he cited literally 1,125 books and articles on the subject, and he seems to have read them all pretty thoroughly, too.
What about this relationship with Jocasta, who would have been literally old enough to be his mother?
Sure, yeah.
There's no sort of background check or on either of their parts to kind of make sure this is a good relationship?
Yeah, well, the way Freud tells the story, it's as if they had never talked about their past ever before until it came up on this one particular day. So
some relationships are like that.
I think so, yeah. When in the part that we just read, Emily, after that, Oedipus goes on to tell Jocasta, as if for the first time, the story of his life. My father was Polybus, my mother Doric Merope, and so on. Material that you would think he would have covered after 20 years of marriage. And Jocasta seems willing when she figures out the truth first and urges Oedipus to stop the investigation. She seems willing to continue their relationship.
Which is odd. And then she goes off and kills herself. And
then she kills herself once it becomes obvious that Oedipus is going to follow the trail to the end. She goes off and kills herself. But before that, she tries to make him, you know, just don't look any further.
That has some psychological validity, too, though. I mean, it's sort of a stopgap measure as soon as he learns the truth. And then quite understandably, well, she couldn't really come to terms with that, you know, for the duration and the second thoughts, you know, you could see would prompt that. Would she have been played with a part of Jocasta been played by a woman? Did they use actresses?
No, the actors were all male.
So that was a very long-standing tradition going all the way into the Renaissance.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Now, Jocasta was, she went along with sort of infanticide in a certain way because they sent young Oedipus off to be killed, right, without much thought?
Yes. I mean, I think the underlying idea is that Jocasta and Laios, when they received this oracle, should not have tried to outsmart the oracle by killing a baby.
And really, was it necessary with the stakes in the feet?
Yeah.
You know, it seems like...
excessive cruelty, sure. The only justification I've ever thought of for that is that there are all of these stories about babies who are exposed in the wilderness and they always survive, you know. So I guess Laios and Jocasta wanted to make darn sure that this child would not survive.
But you could almost look at it as an act of evil that comes back to hit you in the
absolutely.
Face.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I think the lesson of oracles is always to be virtuous and rational and not to go to these extremes to try to avoid your fate.
Well, what's the role in Oedipus's undoing of hubris? I mean, he is a tyrant, right? He's described as a tyrant more than once in this play.
Yeah, he is. It's an interesting question. There's a famous choral song in which they talk about hubris leading to downfall. And the question is, does this apply to Oedipus? Has Oedipus been hubristic, arrogant? Does he believe that he's above the law? And most scholars, translators, critics today say, no, Oedipus was a noble character. His downfall was caused by his determination to discover the truth for the highest of reasons. That's the standard interpretation. I'm inclined to see it differently. I think his effort to avoid his fate and his killing the old man at the crossroads, I think that's blameworthy behavior. But I suppose the ultimate truth, I think, is that there are some aspects of his character and the situation that Sophocles has left indeterminate, and everybody is going to see a slightly different Oedipus when they read the play. You're going to fill in the blanks on the basis of your own knowledge of human nature and of yourself, and your own experiences, and everybody comes up with a slightly different Oedipus.
What about the theme of seeing when you're literally blind, being blind when you can see, which we're used to from Shakespeare, from Lear and other plays.
Yeah.
But is this one of the first times that we have a literary work where you have a blind man like Tiresias who can see, a seeing man like Oedipus who can't see what's right in front of him and then blinds himself?
Well, the use of Tiresias that way, that's novel. And the theme of blindness reaches a kind of an apex in the Oedipus play. But it's not new in Greek literature. It's a pronounced theme in Homer's Iliad. When Agamemnon gets mad and steals Achilles' slave girl, he later on regrets it and says that he was blinded by the gods. They have this word ate, A-T long E, ate, which is the goddess of blindness and causes people to act blindly. And in these famous examples of blindness, you always suspect that the blindness is motivated. People have chosen not to see what they didn't want to see. And then they make some horrible mistake. And then they say, oh, I was blind. I didn't know what I was doing. Of course, they didn't know what they were doing because they chose not to know what they were doing.
Speaking of knowing what you're doing, you say Sophocles had three more plays to write on this general theme after this. It was part of a tetralogy?
It was part of a tetralogy. We don't know what the other plays were. In the early days, the trilogies were like the Oresteia. They were one continuous story. But that practice was given up early in the 5th century. So Oedipus was probably performed with three other unrelated plays, but we don't know what they were.
But we have, as far as the sequence of these stories, we have Oedipus at Colonus.
Well, that was written many years later. That was written when Sophocles was nearly 90, 20 years later.
And this takes Oedipus into exile and
He goes
blindness.
Into exile in Athens, and he goes into a grove sacred to the Furies, and there's a thunderclap, and he disappears.
with Oedipus Rex, after you've finished working on it so closely to do the translation, what would you say is the most the most relevant parts for someone today? I mean, so much has changed between ancient Greece and now, but then human nature tends not to change. What do you take away from it as meaningful to anyone anytime?
Well, what I take away is what I've already spoken about a lot, the theme of volitional ignorance. I think that's as relevant today as it ever was, that the worst mistakes that people make are mistakes that I think come from that frame of mind where people are in denial about things. They just there are items that they know, but they refuse to recognize. I suppose the overuse of credit, for example, is the sort of thing that people. But I see all sorts of applications of that. To me, it's a very relevant play. I never felt that it was the product of a really distant set of concerns.
Well, it's about human nature in that, as you say. I mean, you believe what you want to believe and don't believe what you don't want to believe, and you can be very unshakable in going from one form of enlightenment to the other.
Right, right, yeah.
And you keep the skeletons in the closet.
yes, right. There's another theme, the very end of the play, and from time to time, people discussing Oedipus have focused on the theme of the fall from high places. And the way the Greeks put it is you can never tell whether a person is happy until they're dead.
Yeah, isn't that a kind of a chilling finale?
This is how the chorus concludes the play. Native residents of Thebes consider Oedipus, one who solved the famous riddle, mightiest of men. Everyone who looked at him was jealous of his fate. What a flood of grim misfortune overwhelms him now. Thus we learn how necessary seeing the final day is for judging mortals blessed. Otherwise, refrain. Happiness means ending life without being crushed by pain.
Well, that must have sent everybody home on a cheerful note.
Talk about a Hollywood ending. Right?
Well, I'm happy to say, at least, that we've gotten to the end of this hour without undue pain, and it's been really quite a pleasant experience delving through the tragedy of Oedipus the King. Thank you, David Mulroy, for coming over from Milwaukee to be with us today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it a lot.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.